All right, let's talk about pharmacotherapeutics that affect tissue and pain perception. And so we're going to hit a lot of the medications for rheumatoid arthritis, fibromyalgia, gout, some of those medications. We're going to start with the DMARDs. When we're looking at the DMARDs, we have three different classifications on our DMARDs. And so when we're looking, we have major non-biologic, major biologic, and then you have your minor non and, it's supposed to be biologic and non-biologic DMARDs. So the ones that I want you to focus on are going to be your methotrexate and your hydroxychloroquine. Now, those are your non-biologic DMARDs. Your biologic DMARDs, when you're looking at them, they're going to end in MAB or SEP. Now, these medications are going to be administered in infusion clinics, you know, in your, you know, cancer and rheumatology clinics. And so as a new novice practicing nurse, we're going to focus more on the methotrexate and the hydroxychloroquine. And so the purpose of these medications is to help slow joint degeneration and the progression of your rheumatoid arthritis. Now, I want you to be able to differentiate in your head the difference in your DMARDs and your NSAIDs. So your disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, when you think about these drugs are used to treat conditions that are autoimmune. And if you think back, your autoimmune disorders, that's where the body is incorrectly identifying something in the body as foreign and it attacks it. And so it is these chronic progressive diseases. Now, your DMARDs are working to prevent that attack, and they do so by helping to prevent the attack, to stop the attack. And your NSAIDs are a reaction to the attack. They come in after the attack to reduce the inflammation. So that's the big difference here in your disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs. So we said here that our goal is to slow degeneration and progression. And so we're trying to maintain joint function for as long as possible and delay the worsening of the diseases. When we're looking at these medications, so we said we're going to focus on methotrexate and hydroxychloroquine. Our methotrexate, the thing I want you to really focus on is the hepatic fibrosis and hepatotoxicity. Now, all of these drugs, if what they're doing is preventing the body from attacking itself, the body can't determine, especially in these autoimmune disorders, foreign versus native. And so if we're preventing the attack on itself, we're going to lessen the attack on things we want it to attack, which is going to result in this immunosuppression, okay? We are weakening the immune system. We're also causing bone marrow suppression. When we think about our bone marrow suppression, I want you to go back in your head. I want you to think about those stem cells. Remember those lines. And so you started, and then those cells turn into these cells, and the line just keeps going and going and going. And what you end up with is red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. And so by suppressing the bone marrow, these stem cells, we're suppressing the amount of red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets that the body is making. Now, these medications also have a tendency to cause GI irritations, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, ulcerations. Now, one of the big things with methotrexate is going to be the fetal death. Okay. So when we look at our contraindications over here, we would obviously not administer this medication to someone who is pregnant if we know that it can cause fetal death and congenital abnormalities. Your hydroxychloroquine can cause both retinal damage, leading all the way to blindness. So we want to make sure that we administer this medication cautiously, and anyone who already has any type of problems with their vision, we want to do a visual acuity check before, and we want to monitor any changes as we administer the medication. Now, your contraindications with your methotrexate, also we've got this liver failure. If we know it's going to cause hepatotoxicity, we're not going to administer it in liver failure. We're not going to use it with alcohol use disorders because that alcohol is also hard on the liver. And we're not going to use it with any blood disorders because we know that we are suppressing those stem cells. Interactions, methotrexate interacts with your nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories, your aspirins, sulfonamides, penicillins, tetracyclines, as well as folic acid. So we need to be cautious and not administer those together. We obviously do use antibiotics and NSAIDs with methotrexate, but we have to be very cautious because we're increasing the risk of those GI disturbances, the bone marrow suppressions, because we don't have enough platelets. If we did have any type of bleeding, we would have decreased ability to stop that. So for our nursing administration, so we want to advise our clients that the DMARDs have a delayed reaction and can take up to 3 to 6 weeks for full therapeutic effect. Now, based on some of the conversation that we've just had, there's other things that I would like you to consider. If we know that it's causing bone marrow suppression, we're going to need to monitor for any type of bleeding. We're going to monitor for infections. We're going to screen for any type of infectious diseases before we start this medication and while we are on this medication. We're also going to make sure that we have educated our patients on how to prevent infections for your vaccines. We're not going to administer any live vaccines. Okay, we are going to try to administer any attenuated vaccines prior to beginning therapy with these medications. And then because of that risk of fetal death and congenital abnormalities, we want to make sure our patients are aware to use a reliable form of contraception. All right, next we're going to talk about our anti-gout medications. When we're talking about our anti-gout medications, I did go ahead and break these up into two sections. Okay, I didn't break them into two medications. I broke them into two different sets of slides. So your book combines your anti-gout with your hyperuricemics. I did break these up in the slides. All right, so let's talk about these. So your anti-gout medications include your colchicine as well as your nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories. Those nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories that are specifically used for gout include indomethacin, naproxen, as well as diclofenac. We also use glucocorticoids, including your prednisone, for the treatment of gout. Now, I want you to, when you think about these anti-gouts, I want you to think acute gout. This is an acute onset, active gout. These are not the ones that we use routinely more to prevent gout. So, also, I want you to remember that colchicine is the only effective anti-inflammatory used specifically for gout. Colchicine will not be used for inflammation from osteoarthritis or inflammation from, you know, a sprained ankle. It is only going to be effective for inflammation that is caused by gout. The rest of these medications will reduce inflammation systemically. All right. GI side effects. Okay. Most common side effect caused by colchicine, as well as your nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories, also causes some thrombocytopenia, reduction in thrombocytes, and can cause just generalized muscle aches and pains. It is contraindicated for patients who have severe renal, severe cardiac, hepatic, or GI dysfunction. We want to be careful in using it with our elderly patients. Now, this grapefruit juice, remember when we talked earlier in the semester about the CYP3A4? It's an enzyme that's created in the liver, and the metabolism of drugs is significantly affected by its inhibition or use of the CYP3A4 enzyme. So your colchicine is a CYP3A4 inhibitor, and so we want to avoid using eating grapefruit or drinking grapefruit juice while you're taking colchicine. For your nursing administration, we want to make sure that we educate our patients about the risks that come with these, including the risk of the GI side effects, so increasing your fluid intake so that it compromises for the losses in any diarrhea that you may have or any vomiting that you may have. You want to make sure, because of that thrombocytopenia, that we're making sure that we're monitoring their bleeding risk, their CBC, You know, we can't give it for patients who have severe renal impairments. We need to check their urinalysis, check their kidney functions, and check their liver functions as well. All right, the difference in those and your hyperuricemic medications is your hyperuricemics are aiming to prevent gout attacks. Okay, these are going to be daily medications that patients take to help prevent the buildup of uric acid. Those medications include allopurinol, it includes febuxostat, and probenecid. Your allopurinol and your febuxostat, they inhibit the production of uric acid. So these are known as xanthine oxidase inhibitors. So when you eat purines, your body naturally converts those purines into uric acid. Normally that uric acid is excreted in the urine, no problem. But for patients who either eat too much purine or have inadequate release of uric acid, it develops into gout by settling into joints. And so your xanthine oxidase inhibitors prevent that conversion. Probenecid, however, works to inhibit the reabsorption of uric acid by renal tubules. And so it encourages excretion. Handwriting stinks there, y'all. I'm sorry. All right. When we look at complications, these patients do have a tendency to have hypersensitive reactions that include fever, rash, can cause kidney and liver damage as well, can cause that GI distress, nausea, vomiting. And initially, in those first few months of treatment, it can actually increase the gout attacks. And so a lot of times we will administer this medication with your non-steroidal anti-inflammatories to help reduce that risk of acute treatment. Because of that, we do not give within 2 to 3 weeks of an acute gout attack, especially your probenecid, and then your allopurinol. Long-term use can cause that rhabdomyolysis, and we seem to see that happens more for patients who are taking statins or cholesterol medications. Interactions, aspirin is going to be your biggest one for your probenecid. For your allopurinol, we want to be careful giving it with warfarin because it does increase the risk of bleeding, and that's because of that CYP3A4 inhibition. Make sure you instruct your clients to be sure that they're aware of any potential hidden bleeds, such as the petechiae under the skin, bleeding within the urine. And make sure that while they're taking allopurinol, you encourage them to make sure they get their PT and INR checked routinely. If they do have that hypersensitivity and a rash develops, the patient should stop the medication and report the occurrence. Now, allopurinol can be given IV. I've seen it done maybe twice in 25 years, but if you do, it must be well diluted and you administer it very, very slowly, over 30 to 60 minutes. All right, when we're talking about medications for systemic lupus erythematosus, we're talking about belimumab. This is an immunosuppressant, and the way it works is it disrupts the activity of your B lymphocytes. Your B lymphocytes contribute to the production of autoantibodies, and so we know that systemic lupus erythematosus is an autoimmune disorder. And so if we can stop the production of those antibodies that are attacking itself, then we can decrease the symptoms and the frequency of exacerbations of systemic lupus erythematosus. But remember, if we are attacking the body's immune system, we are creating immunosuppression. And so some of those same concepts that we talked about earlier, the live vaccines, we're going to avoid live vaccines. We're also going to try to administer any attenuated vaccines prior to beginning therapy. We want to make sure that we educate our patients on how to screen themselves for the presence of infections. And we also want to make sure that we teach them good preventative measures to prevent infections. Complications of this medication obviously include your GI effects. The last report I saw was about 15% of patients do develop some type of GI, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. The headache and the depressed mood. Remember, systemic lupus causes some depression just internally, but we want to make sure we're monitoring for an increase in depressed mood. They can certainly have infusion reactions as well as risk for infection, and that's because of that immunosuppressant. We do not give this to patients who are breastfeeding or who have severe renal impairment. Obviously, any other immunosuppressants is only going to increase the risk of immunosuppression. This medication is administered by an IV infusion, usually over about an hour in an outpatient infusion clinic. Those patients are going to be monitored very closely, and we want to make sure that we discard any unused solution. Next, we're going to move to our medications for fibromyalgia. This is going to be your SNRIs, your serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors. You may remember when we talked about neuro, we talked about SSRIs. That was going to be your selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. When we're looking at our SNRIs, what we're doing is we are increasing the availability of serotonin. Remember that serotonin improves your mood. We're also increasing the availability of norepinephrine. Norepinephrine improves your energy, your ability to focus. It decreases pain. Having those two neurotransmitters available in the brain helps with some of the symptoms of the fibromyalgia. Your GABA, we talked about this when we talked about neurology as well. We said that GABA was kind of the brake pedal of the body. It helps to calm neural activity. It reduces those excitatory signals in the brain. And so both of these work to relieve the symptoms of fibromyalgia. When you're looking at your complications, a lot of these are going to be very similar to what you saw when we talked about your antidepressants. Remember that your SNRIs do carry a black box warning for suicidality. And so we need to make sure that we are assessing our patient for, significant suicidal ideations or suicidal tendencies. The big one that I want you to focus on here is withdrawal syndrome. This usually does not necessarily happen because the patient just wakes up one day and says, I don't want to take these anymore. The two most common scenarios that I see is that a good med reconciliation was not performed upon admission. And so this medication gets left off while the patient is inpatient and they develop significant withdrawal syndrome. Symptoms include headaches. Patients describe these headaches as feeling electrical sensations, electrical impulses. They feel like their brain has electricity in it. They develop nausea, fatigue, very significant change just from missing those SNRIs. The other thing I see is that unfortunately they'll call the pharmacy, they're out of refills, we'll contact your doctor. Will they call the doctor's office and the doctor, doesn't have an appointment available. And so they make an appointment for 3 weeks out. Well, that patient's going without. And so by educating your patients, when you administer these medications that we cannot abruptly stop these medications, a lot of times, when they call and they can't get an appointment, if they notify the provider that, hey, I'm on this medication and I need to withdraw from it slowly, then a lot of times we can help get them All right. Also on your GABA, they've got that rhabdomyolysis as well as angioedema. Contraindications, any type of MAOIs or any hepatic or renal impairment are contraindicated for patients to receive this medication. Interactions, if we give it with another antidepressant, especially that affects your serotonin levels, it increases the risk of serotonin syndrome. It can, because of that CYP3-4, interact with warfarin, increasing the risk for GI bleed. Your GABA, we do not want to administer GABA with benzos or alcohol because of the increased risk of drowsiness. And then because of that risk of angioedema, we don't want to administer it with any ACE inhibitors. Your nursing administration, again, tapered withdrawal over 2 weeks. Your GABAs are going to taper over 1 week. We want to, make sure that we administer it, with I don't know why I just said that. We can administer with or without food. It doesn't matter. But where my brain was trying to go is notify your provider with any suicidal thoughts. Because of that black box warning for your SNRIs and GABA causes the same thing. Assess the ability or assess the tendency for suicidal ideations. All right. Your non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. You do not have to know this for testing purposes, but I want to give you a little bit of background on COX-1 and COX-2. If you understand the why behind something, it will make more sense to you. All right. COX-1 is always present in the body, and it has three really good factors. It protects the GI mucosa. It maintains adequate renal perfusion. It makes sure that the blood is transfusing into the kidneys and protecting the kidneys. And it also promotes clotting. Okay. COX-2 is normally low. It only rises in the body during periods of inflammation. And what COX-2 does is causes pain and causes fever. All right. So with that information in mind, knowing that COX-1 is good, COX-2 is bad, our first generation non-steroidal anti-inflammatories inhibited both equally. All right. So they inhibited the bad, which was COX-2. It reduces pain. They reduced fever, but they also inhibited that COX-1 that had those good properties, protecting the gastric mucosa, protecting the kidneys, promoting clotting. All right. So you can see where if patients were given your first generation NSAIDs and COX-1 and COX-2 are both inhibited, you got to take the good with the bad, right? You reduce the fever, you reduced the pain, but you put your patients at increased risk for this gastric injury, for decreased perfusion and kidney injury, as well as bleeding. All right. Well, somewhere along the line, we came up with second generation non-steroidal anti-inflammatories that just took the good. They only inhibited COX-2, which was the bad COX, which caused pain and fever. All right. So that's the difference in your first generation and your second generation NSAIDs. All right. So when we look at our complications, all right, so for your first generation, I'm going to do first generation in pink. Your first generation can cause GI discomfort because we've lost that GI protection. Impaired kidney function, we've lost that renal perfusion. All right, your second generation in yellow, increased risk for heart attack and stroke. All right, the reason being is that by inhibiting only COX-2, we have not inhibited that clotting factor. And so there used to be two COX-2 inhibitors, and one of them was actually pulled off the market because it was shown that it did cause significant heart attack and stroke. Now, let's go red here. So your salicylicism, your Reye syndrome, and your aspirin, these are only in regards to aspirin, which technically is a first generation NSAID. Reye syndrome occurs in children and adolescents who take aspirin during a viral infection. Okay, so for your aspirin, we would not administer it to children or adolescents who have viral infections such as influenza, chickenpox, things like that. All right, your second generation, we said, was in yellow. We're not going to administer it to patients who have cardiovascular disease or sulfa allergies. And then your first generations, we're not going to administer it to peptic ulcer disease because it causes GI discomfort. We're not going to administer it to bleeding disorders because we know that COX-1 helps promote clotting. And if we inhibit that assistance in clotting, we could bleed. And then for any of them, we would not administer it with hypersensitivity. Interactions, your anticoagulants, of course, are going to increase your risk for bleed. Your glucocorticosteroids increase the risk for bleeds. Your alcohol increases the risk for bleeds. On your nursing administration, we want to make sure that we advise our our clients to stop aspirin before any elective surgeries because of that risk of bleed. So before we administer this medication, get a good GI history. Do they have a history of GI bleeds? Do they take, you know, GERD medication every day? You know, do they have any renal impairment? Have they ever, you know, been to a urologist? Have they ever been told they couldn't take a medication because of their kidney functions? Do they have a history of a CV event, cardiovascular event? Have they ever had angina? Did they take medications for angina? You know, things like that. Take a good history ahead of time. We want to administer non-steroidals with food or milk to help reduce that gastric discomfort. And so educating your patients on how to watch for GI bleeds, what it may look like, what it may feel like. You know, those are all important things with your non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. So acetaminophen, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about acetaminophen. I feel like we all know a lot about it. It is used for analgesia and reduction of fever. The only complication is acute toxicity. We want to avoid with three or more alcoholic drinks, and that's because of that hepatotoxicity, and then warfarin, okay? We want to be very careful with warfarin because it increases the risk of bleeding. The thing that I really want you to focus on, Tylenol, is the maximum daily dose of 4 grams. So 4,000 milligrams is the max adult dose of Tylenol for a day. But be cautious because a lot of other medications also contain acetaminophen. Your Norco, it is hydrocodone with acetaminophen. That acetaminophen has to be calculated into your total daily dose of acetaminophen. Your overdose, we talked about already, acetylcysteine. When we're looking at your opioid medications, these are used for the treatment of mild to severe pain. Those include your morphine, your fentanyl, oxycodone. Complications include your respiratory depression. Constipation, we've slowed everything in the body down, sedation, and then opioid overdose. When you look at your contraindications, we want to, you know, make sure because of that respiratory depression, we don't want to give it to any premature infants or give it during or after delivery. Meperidine, we're not really focusing on, so we're not going to spend time on that. Interactions, it includes any type of CNS depressants. We do not administer opioids with barbiturates, phenobarbital, benzodiazepines, or alcohol. Okay. They can cause anticholinergic effects and reduce urinary excretion as well as bowel excretion. So we want to be careful if we administer any other anticholinergic events. And then anything that increases that analgesia, we want to be careful with. All right. Nursing administration, baseline vitals. You got to know what your vital signs are before you administer this. If respirations are 12 or less, notify the provider. This is a double check, Okay, these are controlled substances. You know, if you're wasting, you got to have another nurse waste it. You got to, you know, be very cautious. Don't tote it around in your pocket. You know, if you pull it, administer it immediately. Advise patients about the physical dependence, but we do not discontinue abruptly. Okay, we taper the dose down. This is only the only exception is your cancer patients, and they will be on a fixed dose. All right, lastly, opioid antagonists. These are going to be your antidotes for your opioid analgesics, naloxone and naltrexone. Complications include tachycardia, tachypnea. I'm going to tell one personal story. I try not to tell personal stories on these videos because I don't want them to be any longer than they absolutely have to be. But working in the ER, patient comes in. It was a drug overdose. We felt pretty sure that it was a drug overdose, so we immediately go ahead, pull the naltrexone, getting ready to administer it, but we did not have an IV site. And anytime you have these patients who come in unresponsive, you know, agonal breathing, like everybody shows up, everybody's working, all hands on deck. And one of the nurses had figured out that we were not going to be successful in getting a peripheral IV. And so she begins to get an IO, an intraosseous. And so she is drilling into this patient's leg about the time we hit them with the naltrexone. And so when these patients come to, they come alive. It is almost instantaneously. You give it and these patients wake up. Well, this patient woke up just about the time this nurse is drilling into the bone of their leg. You can imagine the fight that ensued. We were all beat to a pulp by the time that was done. So word to the wise, when you administer this medication, make sure that nobody is drilling an IO into their leg. There are no interactions. Now, the other caution that I will give you is naloxone and naltrexone have a very short half-life, which is usually much shorter than your opioid analgesics. And so you may have to administer multiple doses to exceed the half-life of the opioid that they have taken. So continue to monitor them for that respiratory depression and that overdose syndrome. All right, that's it for this week. I will see y'all next week.